Hello, this is Wendy Bauer, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, September 19th, 2016. We will begin the second half hour with the death notices. First, the deaths listed in Macon County: William L. Gentry of Decatur, Orvaline R. Kite of Decatur, Antonio Javier Quick of Decatur, and in Central Illinois, Catherine E. Lane of Pena, Lloyd G. Mollett of Weldon, Joanne Moody of Clinton, Matthew John Moore of Decatur, Mary Alice Nunnery of Clinton, Norma E. Riley of Clinton. And the list of funerals today: Orvaline R. Kite, 89, from Decatur, funeral at 10 a.m. in North Fork Cemetery. Catherine E. Lane, 94, of Pena, at 10 a.m. in St. Patrick's Church, Pena. Lloyd G. Mollett, 79, of Weldon, at 2 p.m. in St. John's Catholic Church in Clinton. Joanne Moody, 87, of Clinton, at 11 a.m. in Weldon United Methodist Church. Matthew John Moore, 41, of Decatur, at 7 p.m. in Renaissance Church, Decatur. Mary Alice Nunnery, 88, of Clinton, at 10 a.m. in Clinton Church of the Nazarene. And we will go to the obituary pages. William L. Gentry of Decatur. William L. Bill Gentry, 70, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, September 17, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Visitation will be held to celebrate the life of Bill Gentry on Tuesday, September 20, 2016, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Memorials may be directed to DMH Cancer Care Center. Antonio Javier Quick, Decatur. Antonio Javier Quick, infant son of Mary Michael and Samuel Quick of Decatur, died Sunday, September 11, 2016. Funeral services will be at 10 p.m. Friday, September 23, 2016, in the Garden of Angels at Graceland Cemetery. Eugene Anthony Flynn of Decatur. Eugene Anthony Flynn passed away on September 13, 2016, at Imboden Creek Living Center in Decatur. Memorials can be made to the donor's choice. A memorial service for the family and friends is planned for a later date. Catherine E. Lane, Pena. Catherine E. Lane, 94, of Pena, died Friday, September 16th, at Heritage Health, Pena, Illinois. Funeral services will be Monday, September 19th, at 10 a.m. in St. Patrick's Church, Pena. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery, Pena Township, Christian County, Illinois. Donna June Maguette, Decatur. Donna June Maguette, age 86, passed away September 14, 2016 at Decatur Memorial Hospital. As per her request, no services will be held. Memorials may be made to Homeward Bound or Dove, Inc., Decatur, Illinois. Matthew John Moore, Decatur. Matthew John Moore, 41, of Decatur, Illinois, went to be with his Lord and Savior on Monday, September 12, 2016. A family-led memorial service to celebrate Matt's life will be held Monday, September 19, 2016, at 7 p.m. Renaissance Church, 456 North Water Street in Decatur. The family will receive friends beginning at 5 p.m. at the church. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials to the family in care of Gidgetta Moore. Vernon Poling Sullivan. Vernon Poling, 55, of Sullivan, Illinois, formerly of Mill Mine, Illinois, passed away at 11:20 p.m. on Thursday, September 15, 2016. Memorial services for Vernon will be held on Saturday, September 24, 2016, at 11 a.m. at the Hines Funeral Home, 348 North Pyatt Street, Bement, Illinois. Cremation rites will be accorded. Memorial contributions can be made to the Vernon Poling Memorial Fund in care of Hines Funeral Home. Robert F. Sanders, Decatur. Robert F. Bob Sanders, 91, of Peoria, Arizona, passed away August 19, 2016. Memorial services will be at 10:30 a.m. Sunday, September 25th, in Christ United Methodist Church. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the Christ United Methodist Church or Alzheimer's Association. James Wallace of Decatur. James Wallace, 41, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, September 17, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Graveside services to celebrate James's life will be at 1 p.m. Thursday, September 22, 2016, at Mount Auburn Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested to the family in care of Tammy Brandy. Lloyd G. Mollett of Weldon. Lloyd G. Mollett, 79, of Weldon, Illinois, passed away at 5:25 a.m. September 15, 2016, at his family residence in Weldon, Illinois. Mass of Christian burial will be at 2 o'clock p.m. Monday, September 19, 2016, at St. John's Catholic Church, Clinton, Illinois. Burial will follow at Oak Park Cemetery in Clinton with military honors. Visitation was on Sunday, September 18th. Memorials may be directed to the Lloyd Mollett Memorial Fund. And from Decatur on Saturday, four teens charged with murder, attempted murder. Brittany Wilson, 20, was alone in her bedroom of her Northside apartment the night of September 7th as her roommate, Cecily E. Taylor, played dice with 16-year-old Ryan H. O'Neill in the living room. Wilson heard a knock on the front door. Shortly after, Taylor, 21, opened the door. A masked man armed with a handgun entered the bedroom and demanded cash from Wilson. About 9:13 p.m. that night, Taylor was shot to death, and Wilson was seriously wounded by gunshots allegedly fired by 16-year-old Darian L. Evans during the robbery. O'Neill and two other 16-year-old boys were also involved in the robbery and homicide, according to police and prosecutors. The teens netted $40, a pair of Air Jordan sneakers, and a cell phone. Taylor, a 2013 graduate of Eisenhower High School, was pronounced dead at the scene in her apartment in the 1400 block of East Wellington Way. Evans, O'Neill, Shayton Cook Jr., and Daquan Klein were each charged Wednesday morning in Macon County Circuit Court with four counts of first-degree murder. Evans, who allegedly confessed to police that he shot Cecily Taylor after she cursed at him, is facing 20 to 60 years in prison, plus an enhancement of 25 years to life for personally discharging a firearm if convicted. The other three teens are facing the same sentence, except their enhancement is 15 years to life for being armed with a firearm during the commission of the crimes. They will all be tried in adult court. Juveniles 15 and older are automatically transferred to adult court in first-degree murder cases. They are each being held in the Peoria County Juvenile Detention Center on $2.5 million bond. The alleged shooter was on probation for 4 prior crimes, including 3 prior violent offenses. In May, he was ordered to write an essay on gun violence as part of his punishment. Each of the defendants is also charged with 1 count of attempted first-degree murder for shooting Wilson and 2 counts of armed robbery. Each of the counts on the lesser crimes is punishable by 6 to 30 years, plus a 15-year firearm enhancement. The defendants are due in circuit court Wednesday morning to present their attorneys. Wilson was treated for gunshot wounds to her abdomen and legs, according to a police affidavit. After a robber entered the bedroom and held Wilson at gunpoint, another masked gunman forced Taylor into the same room. He also demanded cash, said an affidavit by Decatur Police Detective Eric Matthews. One of the robbers obtained an object off a shelf and another began shooting the gun, striking both her and Taylor, Wilson told police. O'Neill told police he was shooting dice for money with Taylor in the living room of the apartment while Wilson was in the bedroom. There was a knock at the front door and Taylor went to answer the door, O'Neill told police. Taylor opened the door and Klein came into the apartment and attempted to conceal his identity with a shirt wrapped around his head. Cook and Evans quickly forced their way into the apartment as Taylor attempted to slam the door shut. Evans had a Spider-Man mask over his face and the others had shirts covering their faces. Evans later walked Taylor to the bedroom at gunpoint, O'Neill told police. Both Taylor and Wilson were in the bedroom being held at gunpoint by Cook, Evans, and Klein, O'Neill said, adding he went to the bedroom also and was handed a gun by Cook. O'Neill pointed the gun at Wilson and Taylor while his jacket was pulled up over the lower portion of his face to attempt to conceal his identity. This was just a short time after O'Neill played dice with Taylor. After discovering the gun was a BB gun, he returned it to Cook. O'Neill told police he then took a coin purse from the bedroom and went to the living room, where he gave it to Cook. With an unobstructed view of the bedroom, he saw Evans and Klein shooting their guns in the direction of Wilson and Taylor. All the teens then fled the apartment. O'Neill told police that after the shooting, he heard Evans and Klein arguing over who was responsible for the shooting. The stories the defendants told police matched up in many significant details. One defendant said there was a 5th teen at the robbery site, but he was not mentioned by the others. Police are investigating that possible involvement. Evans told police that he was with Klein, O'Neill, and Cook when they all decided to rob the dice game at Taylor's residence. Klein and O'Neill knew Taylor, but he and Cook did not know her. Klein, who drove the vehicle they all occupied, dropped O'Neill off at Taylor's apartment building. He then parked the vehicle a couple of apartment complexes away. Evans and the 2 others then walked to Taylor's apartment. When Taylor opened the door, they all went inside the residence, Evans told police. Evans was wearing a red mask over his face during the incident. Cook went to the back bedroom and demanded money from Wilson. Evans scooped up money from the living room floor where the dice game had been played. He put the money in his pocket, he admitted to police. Evans said he ordered Taylor to the back bedroom where Wilson was being held at gunpoint by Cook, Matthews wrote in his statement. The gun Cook brandished was a BB gun, but the gun he had was a real one, a deuce-deuce or deuce-5, a 22 or 25 caliber handgun, he told police. Evans stated that Taylor began yelling and cursing at him, and so he shot Taylor 1 or 2 times. Evans stated that when he shot Wilson, he shot her an unknown number of times. He said everything happened so fast and he did not remember exactly what happened while he was shooting the victims. Evans estimated that he had 5 bullets in the gun before he began firing. An autopsy performed the following day showed that Cecily Taylor suffered 2 gunshot wounds to her chest and 2 to her left arm. These were wounds caused by 4 separate bullets, the report said. She died from the gunshot wounds to her chest. She was pronounced dead at 2:21 a.m. September 8th by the Macon County Coroner's Office. Evans denied that there were any other real guns used during this shooting. He said he threw his gun into a lake. At the time of his arrest on September 8th, Evans, who has an extensive juvenile criminal history, was serving 4 probation terms for convictions on 4 separate cases. On May 21st, he was sentenced to 18 months probation for 2 cases of aggravated robbery. He was ordered to write a 5-page essay on gun violence and perform 50 hours of public service. On November 17th, he was sentenced to 18 months of probation for aggravated battery, public place, and residential burglary. Valerie Wells, Herald and Review staff writer, writes from Decatur, Eisenhower's Kistler Scott Fine Arts Wing dedicated. During the years that Shirley Kistler and Milt Scott oversaw fine arts education at Eisenhower High School, the two educators built a legacy. On Saturday, former students and the Decatur School District honored their hard work with the dedication of the Kistler Scott Center for the Performing Arts. It is a wing of Eisenhower High School that includes the choir and band rooms and auditorium. The plaque with the new name was unveiled after the ceremony, and that was followed by a reception. Kistler, known fondly as Mama Kay and the Queen, received a crown and scepter from former students dressed as football players. During her years teaching, the football ballet was part of talent shows, when football players would come out dressed in frilly tutus, and the men did that too. Reminiscing about her days teaching and the partnership with Scott, Kistler spoke of the first musical they put on together, mistakenly referring to it as The Sound of Music. It was The Music Man, Scott called from his seat in the auditorium. Laughing, Kistler corrected herself and said she would speak of any other productions by name, or Milt will correct me. The thought of hanging up on the wall with you for eternity makes my head hurt, she quipped to Scott. Their long association made for several such remarks, and Scott opened his speech with, I'd like to thank Shirley for her kind words, but I didn't hear any. It's been a long road to get here, said Susan York, who started the push to get the wing named for Kistler and Scott. All of this started 2 years ago with the naming of the auditorium, York said, referring to the agreement between the school board with retiring Superintendent Gloria Davis to name the auditorium for her. A group of alumni thought that honor should have gone to Kistler and Scott. I started a petition on change.org, which drew 2,000 signatures, York said. Before Superintendent Lisa Taylor left, they instituted a new naming convention where a committee takes it to the board for approval, and we amended our petition. They took it to the board and requested naming the whole Fine Arts Center Kistler Scott. The alumni also contacted the Decatur Public Schools Foundation to create a scholarship for students pursuing a fine arts degree in college. That fund has $4,000 so far, with a goal of $10,000 to keep it sustainable, and donations for that were also solicited at Saturday's event. That scholarship has an online GoFundMe.com account under the Kistler Scott Fine Arts Foundation, or donations can be sent directly to the Decatur Public Schools Foundation in care of Zach Shields, 101 West Cerro Gordo Street, Decatur, Illinois, 62523. The foundation will oversee the scholarship. We need to support them in the arts, York said. It's not like when the baby boomers were here and there were 1,500 kids in the school. They need help. The entire event was live streamed on the group's Kistler Scott Dedication Facebook page, which has more than 700 members. It was a closed group to prevent the honorees from finding out about some of the surprises planned, but will be open after this and will include a video of the event. One of those surprises was a flash mob made up of choral alumni who, singing the warm-up exercise Scott always used with them, approached the stage after his remarks and performed Honor and Glory, a staple of his choral repertoire under his direction. Scott did not know ahead of time that he would be directing those songs, York said with a chuckle. At the end of the ceremony, an album made in the 1970s featuring the school choir was played. During the high school's heyday in musical theater, licensing for shows was so expensive that the school put on an annual talent show to raise money, something like an old vaudeville show. The card art was always done by J. Michael Durneal, an alumnus, and he made cards for Saturday's show too, flipping the last around with the word finale on it in capital letters. MC was alumnus Scott Reuter. Licensing is still expensive, and there was a lull of several years when Eisenhower didn't put on its traditional shows. But that changed a few years ago, said Principal Amy Zahm Duncan, and the new auditorium, with its state-of-the-art technology, has provided a suitable venue. Kistler is a graduate of Eisenhower. She graduated from Illinois State University in 1965 and returned to Eisenhower to teach English, speech, and acting. She also holds a master's degree in counseling. She retired in 2001. Scott is a graduate of Millikan University with a bachelor's in music and a master of choral conducting from Illinois State University. He retired in 2000. Both have continued to be active in fine arts in Decatur. Kistler is a member of the Decatur Public Schools Foundation Board and MC for the Decatur Municipal Band, while Scott is an original member and the current director of vocal group Opus 24 and minister of music at First Lutheran Church. And from the opinion page, we'll read an editorial by Leonard Pitts Jr., Election, a Moment of Truth for Us All. I know you are, but what am I? Maybe you remember that one from the schoolyard. It was one of those unanswerable taunts. I'm rubber, you're glue, was another, widely favored by smart alecky kids, a bit of verbal judo that took an attacker's thrust and turned it back against her. I know you are, but what am I? Most of us outgrew the riposte about the same time we outgrew passing notes in class. Apparently Donald Trump never did. Far from leaving it behind, he has honed it into a political tool perfect for this era of post-factual lassitude and cognitive dissonance. As campaign 2016 grinds toward a reckoning, we are seeing that tool employed with breathtaking shamelessness. It works like this. Whatever Trump is called or accused of, he turns it back on the accuser. Did you ever see that scene in The Equalizer where a bad guy points a gun at Denzel Washington, and faster than the eye can follow, Denzel snatches the gun and points it back at him? It's something like that, except with words. So the man who claims that he's always opposed the Iraq War, even though he didn't, the man who said the election is rigged, even though it isn't, the man who told us Barack Obama founded ISIS, even though, duh, he didn't, the man whose PolitiFact scorecard rules over 80% of his rated statements as half-truths and untruths, that man complains that Hillary Clinton is a world-class liar. And the man whose idea of releasing medical information is a brief note from his doctor so loopy, imprecise, and filled with wild, extravagant claims that Trump will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency, that one doctor dubs it medically illiterate, that man tells us it's the mysteries of Hillary Clinton's health we ought to be concerned about. And the man who said a judge was unfit to judge because he is of Mexican heritage, the man who wants a ban on Muslim immigration, the man who retweets racists and anti-Semites, the man who is openly beloved by white supremacists to the point that former Klansman David Duke seems about ready to kiss him on the lips, that man condemns Hillary Clinton as a bigot. Not to put too fine a point on it, but having Donald Trump lecture you about bigotry, transparency, or truth is rather like having Kanye West tell you to stop behaving like a jackass. In psychology, they have this phenomenon called projection. The Cambridge Dictionary of Psychology defines it as a primitive defense mechanism that involves the unconscious warding off of negative experiences or emotions by denying an experience, perceiving it in another person, and then seeing that negative experience as being directed back at the projector. Which sounds like what we're seeing here, except there is nothing unconscious about it. No, this is calculated, born of a conviction that there really is a sucker born every minute, and that an alarming proportion of them vote in American elections. So the challenge here is simple. What will we say in response? How will we answer this insult to intelligence? Or are we too sick of it to care? One has a sense of an electorate pummeled into emotional submission, which is hardly surprising. It's been a long, dispiriting campaign, largely bereft of ideas, proposals, and uplift. But it is important to remember that November will be a moment of truth in more ways than one. Indeed, November will answer a critical question. You say Trump is an ignorant narcissist unfit for the White House? Yes, we know he is. But what are we? And finally, an editorial. What others are saying, consumer protections still needed. As bank customers across the country continued to fume Tuesday over news of Wells Fargo's fraudulent accounts scandal, a House committee attacked the very law that guards against that kind of scheme. Talk about embarrassingly bad timing. On second thought, maybe it was good timing, in that it highlights how wrong-headed Republicans in Congress are to keep trying to dismantle the Dodd-Frank Act banking reforms passed in the wake of the financial crisis. Dodd-Frank created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the federal agency that fined Wells Fargo a record $100 million for reopening millions of fraudulent accounts, for opening millions of fraudulent accounts, often without customers' knowledge. Singing from the aggrieved bank executive's favorite songbook, Republicans say Dodd-Frank brings too much confusing red tape, stifles private sector growth, and simply isn't necessary. Quite the contrary, if the Wells Fargo scandal is any indication. It went on for years, apparently. Some 5,300 employees have been fired. When politicians talk about Wall Street as a criminal enterprise, New York Times business columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin noted, this is exactly what they're talking about. CEO John Stumpf, in an interview with Wall Street Journal, defended the bank's culture and blamed the now dismissed employees. There was no incentive to do bad things, he told the Journal. Few people seem willing to take him at his word, nor should they, given this egregious abuse of the public's trust. E. Scott Reichard, the retired Los Angeles Times business writer who broke the story, told Columbia Journalism Review his reporting started with one Wells Fargo employee. The worker said he'd talked to people into signing up for accounts and services they didn't need. Why? He described incredible pressures to make sales numbers, Reichard said. Sounds more like a failure of corporate culture than a problem of rogue employees. Wells Fargo's public relations debacle should serve as a warning to other banks. We hope it helps Congress understand that we need to fine-tune Dodd-Frank, not gut it, and that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau must be strengthened, not killed. This has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, September 19, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again in the future. Thank you.